My own prediction is that the slow bleed has been accelerating and is only the first step. The second step will be speculative attacks that use Bitcoins as a platform. The third and final step will be hyper-Bitcoinization. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I went digging. Everybody's talking about the speculative attack, and we talked about it. I was on the Swan Signal live podcast the other day, and we really kind of dug into the concept, and I had a number of people say, oh, you should reboot The Speculative Attack by Pierre Richard, written way back in 2014, because we're kind of seeing... we're seeing this game theory play out that Pierre wrote about literally 6 years ago. And this is in reference, by the way, to Michael Saylor. They have basically issued bonds. They've issued notes against the company, basically created themselves a debt that they are going to sell for, I think they were five-year bonds or five-year notes. And which will give them $400 million in extra capital to buy Bitcoin. So because interest rates are so low and they can get this capital at incredibly, or they can make this this debt for themselves at incredibly low rates, they're basically taking the fact that they know that the dollar is going to devalue at 15-20% a year. Against like their liability will against an asset that they can hold that will appreciate heavily. It makes no sense to not just take out as much debt as humanly possible and borrow, like just inflate the dollar to get more Bitcoin as quickly as you can. And that's what we're going to dig into today. I was 99% sure that we had done this on the show, but I can't find it anywhere. And I've had a couple other people tell me, where's your episode? I can't find it. They can't find it either. So we're just going to read it again. quick thank you to our sponsors. We have got three awesome sponsors right now for the show. A full lineup here. We've got the Hexa mobile wallet, which is a great non-custodial wallet with tons of great features. Then we've got your cold storage, which is the Bitbox O2, a minimal, open source, secure, and really easy to use a Bitcoin hardware wallet. And then of course, Levvl.co, that's LVL.co, which is a exchange, a no fee exchange, and a full set of Bitcoin banking services. Direct deposit, wires, checks, debit card, the whole game. So you can check all of those out. I'll have them actually across the top so you can check out those services at guyswan.com. But with no more delay, we are going to read from the Nakamoto Institute. They are an incredible resource for all of the critical, like, prerequisites to getting into, you know, Bitcoin 101. And we've read tons of them on the show. They are just amazing. And this piece, again, is by Pierre Richard, and it was published on July 4th, 2014. And it is titled, The Speculative Attack. Introduction. Bitcoin naysayers wring their hands over how Bitcoin can't go mainstream. They gleefully worry that Bitcoin will not make it across the innovation chasm. It's too complicated. It doesn't have the right governance structure. The security is too hard to get right. Existing and upcoming fiat payment systems are or will be superior. It's too volatile. The government will ban it. It won't scale. The response from the Bitcoin community is to either endlessly argue over the above points, or to find their inner Bitcoin Jonah with platitudes like, Bitcoin the currency doesn't matter, it's the blockchain technology that matters. It would be better if the blockchain technology were used by banks and governments. Bitcoin should continue to be a niche system for the bit curious. It's just an experiment. Fiat and Bitcoin will live side by side, happily ever after. Bitcoin is the MySpace of virtual currency. The above sophisms are each worth their own article, if just to analyze the psychosocial archetypes of the relevant parrots. A few of the criticisms mentioned earlier are correct, yet they are complete non sequiturs. Bitcoin will not be eagerly adopted by the mainstream. It will be forced upon them. Forced as in, quote, compelled by economic reality. People will be forced to pay with bitcoins, not because of, quote, the technology, but because no one will accept their worthless fiat for payments. Contrary to popular belief, good money drives out bad. This driving out has started as a small fiat bleed. It will rapidly escalate into class 4 hemorrhaging due to speculative attacks on weak fiat currencies. The end result will be hyper-Bitcoinization, i.e., your money is no good here. Thiers' Law. Good money drives out bad. Quote, historically, it has been good, strong currencies that have driven out bad, weak currencies. Over the span of several millennia, strong currencies have dominated and driven out weak in international competition. The Persian Daric, the Greek Tetradrachma, the Macedonian Stater, and the Roman Denarius did not become dominant currencies of the ancient world because they were bad or weak. The florins, ducats, and sequins of the Italian city-states did not become the dollars of the Middle Ages because they were bad coins. They were among the best coins ever made. The pound sterling in the 19th century and the dollar in the 20th century did not become the dominant currencies of their time because they were weak. Consistency, stability, and high quality have been the attributes of great currencies that have won the competition for use as international money. By Robert Mundell, from Uses and Abuses of Gresham's Law in the History of Money. Bitcoins are not just good money, they are the best money. The Bitcoin network has the best monetary policy and the best brand. We should therefore expect that Bitcoins will drive out bad, weak currencies. By what process will Bitcoins become the dominant currency? Which fiat currencies will be the first to disappear? These are the interesting questions of the day, as the necessary premises for these questions are already established truths. 1. Fiat bleed. Bitcoin's current trend is to increase in value on an exponential trend line as new users arrive in waves. The good money is slowly driving out the bad. Two factors drive this. 1. Reduction in information asymmetry. People are learning about Bitcoin and coming to the realization that Bitcoins are indeed the best money. Possible overlapping motives. ADHD, compulsive novelty fetishism induced by our post-war consumer culture and/or innate biological processes. FOMO, the fear of missing out. See regret theory and in-groups, aka avarice and status seeking. PISD, post-internet stress disorder, aka disruption, quote, the next big thing, quote, the internet of money. 2. Increasing liquidity. Buying bitcoins is more convenient and has fewer fees attached today than a year ago. One can reasonably predict that this will also be the case a year from now. Why? Because selling bitcoins is a profitable and competitive business. Why? Because people want bitcoins. See above. Due to group psychology, these newcomers arrive in waves. The waves have a destabilizing effect on the exchange rate. Speculators are unsure of the amplitude or wavelength of adoption, and amateurish punters let their excitement as well as subsequent fear overwhelm them. Regardless, once the tide has pulled back and the weak hands have folded, the price is a few times higher than before the wave. This slow bleed is the current adoption model, and commentators generally assume one of the following. 1. The slow bleed never occurred. It is a fiction based on misleading data. 2. The slow bleed has stopped. The above motives only affect lolbertarians and angry teens. Or 3. The process will taper off now, as all the super tech savvy people have already gotten on board. My own prediction is that the slow bleed has been accelerating and is only the first step. The second step will be speculative attacks that use bitcoins as a platform. The third and final step will be hyper-bitcoinization. 2. Currency crises. Quote, it might make sense just to get some in case it catches on. If enough people think the same way, that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Once it gets bootstrapped, there are so many applications. If you could effortlessly pay a few cents to a website as easily as dropping coins in a vending machine. Satoshi Nakamoto, January 17, 2009. Slow bleed leads to currency crisis as the expected value of bitcoins solidifies in people's minds. At first, they are conservative. They invest what they can afford to lose. After 12 to 18 months, their small stash of bitcoins has dramatically increased in value. They see no reason why this long-term trend should reverse. The fundamentals have improved, and yet adoption remains low. Their confidence increases. They buy more bitcoins. They rationalize, well, it's only 1 to 5% of my investments. They see the price crash a few times due to bubbles bursting or just garden variety panic sells. It entices them to buy more. A bargain. Bitcoin grows on the asset side of their balance sheet. On the liability side of the Bitcoiner's balance sheet, there are mortgages, student loans, car loans, credit cards, etc. Everyone admonishes people to not borrow in order to buy bitcoins. But the reality is that money is fungible. If you buy bitcoins instead of paying down your mortgage's principal, you are a leveraged Bitcoin investor. Almost everyone is a leveraged Bitcoin investor because it makes economic sense within reason. The cost of borrowing, annualized interest rates ranging from 0% to 25%, is lower than the expected return of owning bitcoins. How leveraged someone's balance sheet is depends on the ratio between assets and liabilities. The appeal of leveraging up increases if people believe that fiat-denominated liabilities are going to decrease in real terms, i.e., if they expect inflation to be greater than the interest rate that they pay. At that point, it becomes a no-brainer to borrow the weak local currency using whatever collateral a bank will accept, invest in a strong foreign currency, and pay back the loan later with realized gains. In this process, banks create more weak currency, amplifying the problem. The effect of people, businesses, or financial institutions borrowing their local currency to buy bitcoins is that the bitcoin price in that currency would go up relative to other currencies. To illustrate, let's say that middle-class Indians trickle into bitcoin. Thousands of buyers turns into hundreds of thousands of buyers. They borrow Indian rupees using whatever unencumbered collateral they have, homes, businesses, gold jewelry, etc. They use these rupees to buy bitcoins. The price of bitcoins in Indian rupees goes up. A premium develops relative to other currency pairs. A bitcoin in India might be worth $600, while in the US it trades at $500. Traders would buy bitcoins in the US and sell them in India to net a $100 gain. They would then sell their Indian rupees for dollars. This would weaken the Indian rupee, causing import inflation and losses for foreign investors. The Indian central bank would have to either increase interest rates to break the cycle, impose capital controls, or spend their foreign currency reserves trying to prop up the rupee's exchange rate. Only raising interest rates would be a sustainable solution, though it would throw the country into a recession. There's a huge problem with the Indian central bank raising interest rates. Bitcoin's historical return is about 500% per year. Even if investors' expected future return is one-tenth of that, the central bank would have to increase interest rates to unconscionable levels to break the attack. The result is evident. Everyone would flee the rupee and adopt bitcoins due to economic duress rather than technological enlightenment. This example is purely illustrative, It could happen in a small country at first, or it could happen simultaneously around the world. Who leverages their balance sheet and how is impossible to predict, and it will be impossible to stop when the dam cracks. Which countries are most vulnerable to a currency crisis? Business Insider provides a helpful list here, link included. Bitcoins will have to reach a certain threshold of liquidity, indicated by a solid exchange in every financial center and a real money supply, i.e. market cap, of at least $50 billion before they can be used as an instrument in a speculative attack. This will either coincide with or cause a currency crisis. 3. Hyper-Bitcoinization. A speculative attack that seems isolated to one or a few weak currencies, but causes the purchasing power of Bitcoins to go up dramatically, will rapidly turn into a contagion. For example, the Swiss will see the price of Bitcoins go up tenfold, and then a hundredfold. At the margin, they will buy Bitcoins simply because they want to speculate on their value, not due to an inherent problem with the Swiss franc. The reflexivity here entails that the reduction in demand for Swiss francs would actually cause higher than expected inflation, and thus an inherent problem with the Swiss franc. The feedback loop between fiat inflation and Bitcoin deflation will throw the world into full hyper-Bitcoinization, explained by Daniel here. Conclusion. Bitcoin will become mainstream. The Bitcoin skeptics don't understand this due to their biases and lack of financial knowledge. First, they are in as strong an echo chamber as Bitcoiners. They rabidly search for evidence that confirms their own view of Bitcoin. Second, they misunderstand how strong currencies like Bitcoin overtake weak currencies like the dollar. It is through speculative attacks and currency crises caused by investors, not through the careful evaluation of tech journalists and mainstream consumers. To honor the soon-to-be extinct skeptics, the Nakamoto Institute has launched A Tribute to Bold Assertions. By Pierre Richard. All right, so I'm going to go get something to drink before we sit down for Guy's take on this one. I think it's going to be really good. I'll try to wrap it up quick, but there is some really fantastic gold. And just the fact that this is written in 2014, and now we're essentially witnessing this live, is just amazing. Pierre's forethought on this, the prescience of explaining how this works and knowing the history of money, because that really is the important piece here, is what happens when a strong currency and a weak currency meet, how does the transition from one to the other actually occur. So we're going to get a little bit deeper into that in just a second. Let's hit our sponsor real fast and we'll come right back. So every single exchange in Bitcoin uses the same model, right? They use transaction fees. Level.co believes that the future of Bitcoin is free. They are creating a game-changing service. So they are bringing Bitcoin banking to the U.S. with direct deposits, checks, wire transfers, a debit card, and zero conversion fees. Their profit model is simply to charge a flat rate of $3 for withdrawals, and which actually includes the network fee, and then $5 for same-day bank transfers and wires. And then, of course, they offer additional benefits like a private banker, a world debit card, and autopilot trading for anyone who spends just $9 a month. You have got to check these guys out. If you are in a state that they are available in, they are in 28 so far, and then please come tell me about it so that you can make me jealous. Level.co, LVL.co, you got to check it out. So this is literally what Michael Saylor just did, and it appears they're trying to do it with near $500 million worth. They're leveraging their company, the earnings of their company, in order to issue themselves or to sell debt to other people to get capital that they can then put into their treasury, invest in Bitcoin, and hold for that 3 to 5 year period. The reason I say, even though it's a 5 year note or whatever that they've issued, or notes that they have issued is that after 3 years, they have the ability to buy them back. So, you know, if Bitcoin has a hell of a 3 years, they could just be like, all right, well, we'll just take them right back, buy them at whatever the rate was that we're sold them at. And we don't have any of the details yet, but this is it. This is the game theory that Pierre was breaking down in 2014, basically coming to fruition today. And I really think this is only going to accelerate. And the beauty of this, the really where the understanding of this comes from is just what happens when a weak currency meets a strong currency. A weak and a hard money come together, and this is the dynamic at play. And it is never because, you know, everybody's mind changed, and you look throughout all of history why the strong money, how it dominated and pushed out the bad money from society. It wasn't like everybody just decided like, oh, this is a better money. It wasn't as if like everybody was like, you know, they made the assessment that this one was going to work better. It was simply the dynamics of normal economic activity created a price differential, a imbalance with the core scarcity and hardness of one money versus another, and that it simply can't be ignored for an extended amount of time. And Bitcoin is the perfect example of this. It is the hardest money we've ever had to be placed in a situation like this, and it is fighting. It is sitting there in the face of hundreds of garbage currencies that are actually in the worst situations they've been in 100 years, particularly when we're talking about the dominant Western currencies. And one of the things he says, you know, so Michael Saylor is leveraging his business, they're leveraging their company and their profits in order to create this speculative attack to get the fiat so that they can dump it into Bitcoin and they can hold. And they know, I mean, he says explicitly, you know, it's like it's 15 to 20% inflation. You know, if he gets a 10% loan out of this, like if he's got an obligation of 10% on the liability that he's holding, just getting the loan is worth it. If you can have something that doesn't lose money over that period of time, because the liability is going to devalue by 15 or 20%. And, you know, Pierre says in this piece, it really goes into it and, you know, explains there are very simple ways to fix this. There's basically only three. They have to implement capital controls, which a lot of countries are, and I fully expect to see continued. But what's completely backwards about capital controls is that as soon as a country is under capital controls and you're starting to see that bleeding of the value of the currency begin to accelerate, that is exactly the incentive that makes Bitcoin the most important thing to pay attention to. Like capital controls are the incentive for Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is censorship resistant and it has no jurisdiction, it has no borders. Capital controls are the exact opposite. If a country starts to really enact capital controls, Iran's a perfect example. There's capital controls all around Iran. What have they suddenly started doing? The central bank is buying Bitcoin in order to use for international trade so that they can get around the capital controls. Doing that that is the Streisand effect. It will pull way more attention to Bitcoin to impose capital controls to try to prevent a speculative attack like this. Then another is to spend their foreign currency reserves. So they either spend, in the example of the Indian central bank, they would be spending their dollars, or they'd be spending their euro that they have in reserves, or their gold in reserves to basically buy their own rupee back, to buy their own currency back. But what's funny is that is a short-term fix. It paints over the surface of the rusted car for a little while so that it looks fresh. But by destroying the reserves, by not having any reserves, it puts their currency in an even worse situation. So neither of those are actually solutions. They're temporary impediments to something that then accelerates the problem after the impediment is worked around, which the market works around those things very quickly. As soon as with no reserves, the rupee will just eventually get, they'll eventually run out of reserves and the rupee will then plummet, or the currency in question will then plummet for the country itself not having any reserves. And then in capital controls, like I said, we'll just call vastly amounts of more attention toward Bitcoin because it will be exactly the tool needed to get around capital controls. So the only solution, the only sustainable solution, and the only reasonable solution that will actually work, or that would work for a short period of time, again, it still is not, there's not really any fix, because the only fix is to have a harder currency than Bitcoin, and that's never going to happen. No fiat currency can be harder than Bitcoin. But the only sustainable solution is to raise interest rates and actually go back to a market economy for debt and liabilities. But that causes an absolute collapse of the economy, which again makes Bitcoin the only way out. Because if there's no economy for the rupee, then the rupee is devalued. So you end up with a dual deflationary and inflationary crisis on your hands in that currency, because currency is basically being deleted from the system because so much of it is based on debt specifically. And as people are going bankrupt and defaulting, that currency is deleted. But then at the exact same time, what makes a currency value is what you can buy with it. Is the size of the economy that's backing that currency. And in a country like that, the economy is basically plummeting, and there's no employment. Like, that's stagflation, right? That's when you have the credit crisis and an inflationary crisis kind of in tandem, because the economy is just utter crap. So basically, there's no way out of this. The only solution is to have a harder currency than Bitcoin, and that is the one thing that won't be able to happen. But if you just look at how the central banks work and kind of the history of this stuff, none of that's going to happen. Like, probably spending their currency reserves and their capital controls will happen, but nobody will lower or raise interest rates. They know that's the nail in the coffin. It's the gig is up at this point. And if you look at the history of the interest rates and like where we've gone, this is a 50-year problem. This is a 60-year problem, easy. And it's not just going to be undone. They're not going to just be like, yeah, free markets and money all of a sudden. All of the $1 trillion in advantages and power and capital allocation that we've been used to for the last couple of decades, we're just going to stop that. It's not going to happen. They're going to go negative, and then they're going to try to fight it. They're going to implement capital controls. They're going to do anything that they can to prop up their currencies. But it's going to be a mess. And the fact that it really is the smart move. I talked about it in I can't remember what episode it was. There was an episode some time ago in the guy's take that I talked about. If you save in fiat in a bank, because the interest rates are so low, I use an example of like I had some small amount of money, decent amount is like some hundreds of dollars or like $1,000 or something in a savings account for an extended period of time, just because, you know, it was just there and I wasn't touching it. And I had gotten gotten a check from my bank. And it was for 15 cent. And I just thought that was hilarious because, you know, that's the incentive to save right now, right? The stamp it took to get that letter to me plus the piece of paper was well worth more than the 15 cent I was supposedly being paid, for my savings account. And I said in that episode, I was like, you know, if you save, like, you have to just not understand finance, interest rates, and like what it makes to make a return. Like, the reason there is no savings in the economy, the reason we are absolutely loaded with debt, is because savings is the stupidest thing you can do. To save in fiat money in a bank account at current interest rates is the dumbest place that you could keep money from a financial payoff, like from an actual real return perspective. So if you punish people for doing that, guess what? People don't do it. But I think for the longest time, there's just been no out. There's never been a good currency really to go to. It's just been a competition between shit currencies and shittier currencies. And so people flock to the dollar, and that's been the dollar saving grace. Just the fact that it is the world reserve currency, just the fact that it is the global infrastructure of banking is based around the dollar, it has been the one that everybody else runs to when the local currency starts to get weak. But not because it's a good currency, but because it's a bad currency among worse currencies. All the money is bad. All of it is just crap. And gold is too easy to control. The central banks are the ones who basically have all the gold. Plus, in the digital age, the only way to actually transact or make use of gold is through third parties. It is necessarily centralized, which is, you know, how the gold standard fell away to begin with. It is why gold failed. And we're not less reliant on those problems today. Those problems are even more obvious and more unavoidable. So gold isn't a solution. Gold is less of a solution than it's ever been because we are 100% in the digital age. But now you enter Bitcoin. Now you put this on the map. You put the hardest currency that the world has ever seen. You put the easiest to verify money in the world, and you sit it in this environment of crappy currencies, of negative interest rates, of just endless amounts of liabilities, and where the corporate environment can get debt at a shockingly low rate. And if there's any expectation that Bitcoin will do what it's done every single year since its inception, just half of it, just a 25% increase, just a 50% increase. You know, I think it's like on average, basically every year Bitcoin has doubled, like just 100% return. So even if interest rates were 25%, at some point as Bitcoin becomes liquid enough, it still makes sense to borrow to buy Bitcoin if you can make the spread for the amount of time it takes. But if you're talking about 20% inflation, if you're talking about the value of the dollar losing a quarter over a period of a year, a fifth, then it's a no-brainer. It's the easiest, like, number for number, like, bet on how to get a real return. And again, it's a feedback loop. So as soon as a handful of people begin to realize this with enough capital, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And then the next person has to do it because there's no other option. And the greater market cap, the more liquidity that Bitcoin actually has in its pocket, I guess you say, or in its corner, the worse this problem becomes. When we're talking about, like, it's funny, he's talking about, like, you know, maybe when it gets to a market cap as high as $50 billion, which now we just think of as nothing. We're like in the $300, $400 billion range just today. And I think we're a, you know, hop, skip, and a jump away from $1 trillion. And I think that move will happen a whole hell of a lot quicker than we really think it will. And when it starts to reach that position, like when it starts to reach into those market capitalizations and that amount of liquidity, you're going to see small currencies that see real moves. That's when the capital into Bitcoin, the flow is enough that you actually see when Bitcoin rises, you see the fall in the other currency. Like, for example, when you have like the Japanese yen or the dollar, and the Japanese yen falls, or I guess maybe actually you see the dollar goes up in price, it's specifically you're seeing the Japanese yen fall and all of these other currencies fall in relation to it. Now, obviously, like, if the dollar goes up, you can only weigh it in other currencies. But in the context of the volume, is that there's a measurable real loss of value in those other currencies because the dollar is so big. So everything is relative here. And when Bitcoin reaches that stage and it finds enough liquidity that moving capital into Bitcoin is explicitly a loss of purchasing power for some other fiat currency, for some small country, or for the dollar, or for the yen, or whatever it is, that feedback loop, oh my God, that's something, that's when the slow bleed becomes a fountain. That is when the gradually becomes the suddenly. And like Pierre said, people will not flee to Bitcoin because they had some technological revelation or they've had some ideological shift or now they're all libertarians. They will do it out of economic necessity because people simply won't accept their fiat shit anymore. And I really think this could happen a whole lot quicker than we really suspect it might. You know, maybe we'll still go through phases of this, you know, like dismantling such a giant machine as the international banking system and the currency, you know, the fiat currency throne, I guess you could say, is not something that's going to happen in months. But the value flow, it really potentially could happen all at once to the point that the only way to shore up fiat currencies is to spend your fiat currency in order to get is for a central bank to actually buy Bitcoin for its balance sheet so that the currency itself can at least be considered worth the amount of Bitcoin behind it. And because the value of Bitcoin is increasing at such a rapid pace, Bitcoin may be the only way out to save fiat currency. And I think when we kind of reach that point of no return and central banks begin to realize this, it won't be that one central bank does it and then the others will just, you know, plug their ears. Like, Bitcoin cannot inflate. Like, Bitcoin cannot make more of itself in order to appease the demand for the price to not skyrocket when we enter that phase of things, which means the price is going to go absolutely crazy. And it could be sustained for an incredibly long time. I think, you know, just this move itself could happen, could take a lot longer than we think. You know, we usually consider these hype cycles like a period of a year of a bull market and three bear markets. That might not really be the case going forward. It might not happen that way. I mean, just right now, everybody's talking about the pullback in Bitcoin. This is nothing. This is nothing. If we don't go back to 13,000, then this isn't even a pullback. I would be inclined to think that we will, but the amount of buying pressure that's keeping this chilling at 18,000 is pretty shocking. And like I said, we are entering a new phase of this. You know, Michael Saylor just took out a $400 million loan against his business so that their business can invest in more Bitcoin because they know the dollar liability is going to just vanish in 5 years. They know it's just going to devalue. So it's like, why not? What really is the great risk if we have enough profit to pay the interest rate in the meantime? What's the cost? Like, it's probably going to pay off massively for them. And if anybody else starts doing it at the same time, it will be proof that it's going to pay off massively because only a couple of large corporations and institutions and investors and hedge funds. It doesn't take a whole lot for that to basically come to fruition. And I think we are fully moving into this phase of things. I think it's going to get crazy. You know, 2021 is going to be an insane year. I hope you guys have got your seatbelts buckled. Holy shit. You know, I don't think this is going to stop. I think we're going to get news item and major thing like this development. I mean, just the writing in Bitcoin, I can't even keep up with the good articles. I'm getting 6 or 7 a week of like, oh, I've got to read this on the show. And I don't think I'm going to be able to keep up. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to start hiring some of you people out to just keep up with some of these articles. With that, before we get our final word in here, let's thank our sponsors again for making Bitcoin Audible profitable and allowing me to do this day in and day out and get denser articles here. I've been able to get a lot more articles out lately and I've been able to commit a lot more time to this, and I would not be able to do that without our sponsors and of course our patrons. We have a ton of great people in the Telegram crew, the Audio Knots as they are. I love the group and I thank you all so much for supporting me through the years in which I did this, losing and or barely scraping by. If it weren't for you, I would not have had my coffee to keep this up. But a huge thank you to our sponsors as well. We have got the Hexa mobile wallet, a great non-custodial privacy-preserving wallet. And a really cool feature is that they've got multiple accounts that you can set up within the wallet with multiple degrees of security. So you've got your two-factor savings and your normal checking. So check them out. They are the Hexa wallet, H-E-X-A, guyswan.com/Hexa. And of course, check out the BitBox hardware wallet. Super simple, super secure. I love it. And I've gotten lots of great feedback from many of y'all who have gotten your BitBox and have loved it too. Check them out at guyswan.com/BitBox. And then Level.co. Are you looking for an FDIC-insured bank account with a debit card, direct deposit, wires, checks, and free exchange from one currency to the next without trading fees? Pretty sure Level.co is the only one that'll do that. LVL.co. Gotta check those guys out. So thank you to our sponsors and everyone else who has supported Bitcoin Audible and gotten us here and for taking this crazy, crazy ride with us. And like I said before, I really think we are entering the phase where this is going to get very, very interesting. I think we have fully passed the Bitcoin is not legitimate. It is a joke currency. It is a joke money, and it is magic internet points. And I think everybody who is still clinging to that is, in fact, clinging to it desperately because they know that the writing is on the wall, and they just want to look away from it and ignore it and pretend it's not there. And then you've got these players like Michael Saylor. You've got a lot of these hedge fund managers and these people who are taking a very serious second or third look at Bitcoin and reconsidering their position. And funny enough, on this speculative attack issue, is that we know that Unchained Capital and I think BlockFi are the two that do loans backed by Bitcoin. Bitcoin is the most perfect collateral. It is just a wonderful tool for exactly that sort of thing. And it appears, just hit like while I was going through this this recording, that Fidelity Digital Assets is going to be offering Bitcoin collateralized loans. You're going to be able to deposit your Bitcoin with Fidelity, hopefully in some multi-signature scenario where you're still at least holding one of the keys. Do not know. I haven't dug into it yet. Like I said, it just happened. But then you will be able to get out a loan. And with collateral, you will be able to get out a low interest loan. And since fiat is very easy to loan and get out at low interest, even something like 4 or 5% very well could be profitable for Fidelity or somebody in the position where they can get cheap loans on their own. That is going to be, that very well could be another major source. When institutions like that can get incredibly low interest rates, it will absolutely start to steamroll and people will collateralize their Bitcoin to get loans in fiat to buy more Bitcoin because it's, in our environment, it makes financial sense to do so. And I think it's only going to become more and more true over the next couple of years. So as new developments come on that front, I will keep you guys informed. Don't forget to subscribe and listen to Bitcoin Audible and follow me, Guy Swan, on Twitter. I am the guy who's read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. I love you all, and I will catch you on the next episode. And until then, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you were listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.